I like the fact that it's supposed to be, the underworld and the whole movie, everything in it looks absolutely filthy. Everything's got kind of a, I don't know, it just looks like it has a residue of grime on it or cigarette nicotine stains. It's just that feeling that it gives you is terrific. And you're right on the money in terms of it being very much like a Coen Brothers movie. One thing that just kept going through my mind when I was watching it was how much I felt like this is what Drive Away Dolls wanted to be. But I think this was done so much better. Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show brought to you by Howard Community College, where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about the movies One Life and Love Lies Bleeding, starting with One Life. And Mike, let's start with the good. I mean, this is a true story about someone who did something very heroic during World War II. And those kinds of stories need to be told. So it's always a worthwhile endeavor to make a movie about an unsung hero. So just starting there, what else did you like about the movie?
Well, it's important to have a history lesson before getting to the film review, if you will. And the reason for that is, as Marie indicated, this is very much based on a true life and one that has been celebrated, but I would say under-celebrated. By that, I mean Sir Nicholas Winton, who's the subject of this film, has been called the British Schindler. Schindler himself, and we all know that of him certainly through the Spielberg film, Schindler's List, was, if nothing else, a great self-promoter. And I say that cautiously, but I mean, he knew how to tell a story. He knew how to get the word out there even long before Spielberg made the film. Sir Nicholas Winton was just the opposite. He was so matter of fact. So, do good for the sake of good, but don't look for publicity, that other people had to beat the drum for him that way. And in fact, this film is based on a book by his daughter. And this figure, Nicholas Winton, died as recently as 2015 at the age of 106. So he had a good full life. Now, the history lesson is this. We're talking about Czechoslovakia in 1938. A reminder that Czechoslovakia as a modern nation state only came about in 1918 at the end of World War I, as the map of Central Europe was being redrawn. Yet again, that map has been drawn and redrawn so many times. But as that was happening, the modern nation state of Czechoslovakia came into being. And I've got to stress that it was a democracy. It had a strong economy, had a large standing army. It had so much going for it, a very rich cultural life. But then it also had the misfortune geographically being right in Central Europe. And so even though it was known as the fortress of Central Europe in terms of the munitions capability it had, it was vulnerable because it's surrounded by so many other countries, and most specifically, of course, as Germany is itself rearming, looking towards World War II, there you have Czechoslovakia in the crosshairs. So, okay, 1938, Hitler says he's not looking for war. Hitler says all he wants is the return of traditionally German-speaking lands to the homeland, to the Heimat, and very specifically here, for our purposes, the Sudetenland, because it was a traditionally German-speaking land. It was now part of Czechoslovakia. So what happens in that year is that the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, makes three visits to Germany that year for face-to-face meetings with Hitler. And Hitler assures him that he will not invade any other country. He just wants the return of those territories, and then everything will be fine. To his eternal discredit, Neville Chamberlain believes him and is so credulous and goes along. And in the letter, actually said, Hitler respects me. He would never do anything like invade another country. It's just awful to read this in terms of what actually happened. So in terms of what actually happened, it's what's known as the Munich Agreement in 1938. In effect, Sudetenland is turned over to the Germans. And within a matter of months, they have also then moved into Czechoslovakia itself, which does not fight back. If it had, Germany would have won, but it would have taken grievous losses. It wouldn't have stopped World War II from happening, but I think could have had an impact in terms of weakening the Germans from the get-go. And here's why Czechoslovakia did not fight back specifically. It had a treaty with the French in which the French promised to defend Czechoslovakia in the case of an attack. But the Czechs had reason to worry about that they weren't sure the French would honor the treaty, because the French leader Daladier was kind of mumbling his way through yes, no kind of responses. What happened also was that Great Britain was promising to help the Czechs, but they were wavering as well. So it's all mumble mouth diplomacy. They were wavering. The Soviet Union, however, under Joseph Stalin, promised to defend the Czechs, but the Czechs were dubious for two reasons. One is that they didn't have a shared border with the Soviet Union, so how exactly would the Soviets help them? And the second reason was, can you trust Joseph Stalin? And so when Stalin gave his word, well, what do you believe there? So anyway, the Czechs realized they were on their own, basically. And so the Germans occupied the country in 1938 without a fight. And ironically, when the Germans took over, they had access immediately to hundreds of aircraft, hundreds of tanks, a million rifles, all in the Czech armory, which they would use in their invasion of Poland in 1939. So the tragic outcomes in history. Now, how does that dovetail and lead up to the story we're talking about? Sir Nicholas Winton was a stockbroker in Britain. Now, when you hear that, you think, oh, he's conservative, this and that. But no, in his case, he actually was a socialist and he had German-Jewish background. So he's really a humanitarian that way. And he endeavors on his own to try to rescue children from Czechoslovakia while it could still get out, 1938 specifically. And he puts together a program bureaucratically that did end up rescuing 669 children from Czechoslovakia and brought them to Great Britain. Now you wonder, why just the children? What about their parents and so on? Every country, almost every country, had a quota system. And we won't even talk about the United States in terms of the tragic consequences of that for Jews trying to get out of Europe. But in terms of Great Britain, British law at the time had very strict quota limits on how many adult refugees would be allowed into the country. However, there were no legal restrictions on children under 18. And that explains two programs. One is the better known Kinder Transport, which rescued thousands of children from Germany and Austria and sent them to the UK. Administratively, that was a totally separate operation. So what Winton was setting up was his own operation in Czechoslovakia. That's what this story is all about, with, of course, the great Anthony Hopkins playing Sir Nicholas Winton in his old age and Johnny Flynn playing him as a young man in 38. And the film has been, I won't say faulted, because I really like this film. I mean, I have emotionally, it's very powerful. But there have been some reviews that indicated that, well, you know, it's not your usual cloak and dagger. It doesn't have a lot of the espionage and excitement and blah, blah, blah that you expect from that kind of subject matter. But that's deliberate here. The film reinforces the extent to which this is a bureaucratic process. You have a lot of paperwork to do. You have to try to organize things in not only Czechoslovakia, but back home in Great Britain, because there's somebody at an office desk who needs to stamp it and allow somebody in or not allow them in. That's not exciting to watch necessarily, but you know, it actually is quite compelling here, because you realize that life is a bureaucratic process in a lot of ways. And Nicholas Winton learns how to really work that, how to manipulate it and use it to get as many children in as he can. Now, a heartbreaking aspect is, although he did have those 669 children saved, he had a master list of around 6,000 names, and the other children were not saved, and many of them actually ended up perishing in the camps along with their parents. So that's the backdrop for the story, which takes place in the two time frames, 1938, which I've been talking about, but then it jumps ahead, and it constantly jumps back and forth to 1987, when Nicholas Winton's an old man thinking back on what he did, and being prodded and prompted by others to finally really talk about it at length, which he does when he goes on a television show. It's a This Is Your Life type program in Britain, and that's all very true to the facts of the matter. And the final thing I'll say for the moment, at least, is that Anthony Hopkins is terrific here, reliably terrific. He's such a great actor. And the film has really a tremendous emotional appeal. I found, particularly towards the end of it, when the elderly Nicholas Winton is reunited with some of the now adult children, I saw it with a crowded theater audience, audible sobs. People were really just breaking up as they saw that. And I'm about to break up too, so I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you for the history lesson, Mike, because it's important to put all of those things into context. And I will agree with you that that final scene where you see all the people grown up who the only reason they're here is because he did what he did back in 1938. It's a wonderful story. And I also agree that, you know, the truth doesn't need a lot of embellishment. And we are all kind of spoiled by the unbelievable action we see in superhero movies and everything. So we expect a certain pacing. But you already kind of know the outcome going in. So there's not a lot of tension, other than you hope that he is able to save as many people as possible. I think that's the movie's main weakness, is that you're just sort of observing historical events unfold. And it's done very well. Now, one more thing that really does work is the score. The score is powerful. It really underlies the emotions that they're trying to bring out. And also, Anthony Hopkins is great. Lena Olin is great. Helena Bonham Carter is great. But I actually felt a little ripped off that I was expecting an Anthony Hopkins movie, and I thought less than half of an Anthony Hopkins movie. Not saying Johnny Flynn wasn't good as the younger version, but I wanted more of Anthony Hopkins' ruminations, and not just at the end of his life, but throughout his life. You know, how did he look back on that time period? I wanted more about the man as he got past it, as opposed to focusing so much on him going through it. What did you think, Mike?
Well, there is a certain distancing here that you've identified. And in fact, for about the first hour of the film, I mean, I really appreciated the history lesson there, and it's very well done. But I share your feeling for the early going in the film, where sometimes it's just sort of marking time that way or marking bureaucratic process, which is quite interesting in its own right, but not exactly compelling. And I do share also the feeling that you expressed that, you know, you want more Anthony Hopkins and you want the older man ruminating on his past. But you run into some not just structural, but psychological issues here that may be inescapable. One of them is this is a story by way of structure that's going to spend a lot of time in 1938 with Johnny Flynn, very convincing as a young Sir Nicholas Winton, but then also in 1987. So you're going to jump back and forth. And this becomes very subjective for an audience. Like, how much time do you want to spend in 38? How much in 87? That's the structural issue. And I think the film basically does a pretty good job with that. But the psychological component is the tougher one to consider because Nicholas Winton was so self-effacing. He was not one to ruminate. So here's the problem. If you show him as he really was, and from everything I've read about him, this is really true to his character. He's not one to make big speeches and emote that way. He just wants to like putter around in his yard now that he's retired and this and that. And when people praise him, he wants to kind of shrug and say, oh, well, I did what anyone should have done. And so you're hoping for more there. You're absolutely right. But I don't think there's more to be had if you're being realistic. If you're being dramatic in a really conventional way, you then would have that kind of hyped up hero to the rescue kind of thing. And then in retrospect, basking in it. But that wasn't his character at all. So I think that's kind of inescapable. It is going to be somewhat disappointing, almost sort of flattening that way, that it doesn't quite give you the full emotional rush you'd hope for. But what finally rescued it for me, speaking of rescue, and why I think it is a powerful film, is I share your feeling for like the first half or more of the film. But when it moves into the home stretch, it's really his family and his friends and former colleagues who prod him to go on a BBC show in 1988 called That's Life. And it's kind of a tacky thing and it's sort of glitzy, but this is one of the more serious episodes where you have somebody who really did have a remarkable life. That is really well staged, just in terms of like giving a sense of what a program like that could be and how, yeah, it's sort of fluffy and usually superficial, but once in a while, bam, you get this really powerful real life story. This is the case. And what really won me over, and I was really moved more than I even thought it would be, because so much of the film is rather conventional in terms of the filmmaking and the disappointments you've marked. But when he finally appears there with the audience, he's still as reticent as ever. But you know what? In that audience, when you see all these young to middle-aged adults in the audience watching, many of the people in that audience were real-life survivors. So it's not just actors there as you're watching. I mean, knowing that makes a difference. We just sort of at gut level know it as you're watching it. These are when he's being greeted by some of these now adult children, the emotion they have for him and for me watching it, these are the real people actually greeting him. I mean, that's kind of overwhelming. And that's why the audience really teared up in the last 15 or 20 minutes of it. And other people I was talking with afterwards all said that it really sort of caught them by surprise that way. Yes, they expect it to be moving, but a lot of it was, as Marie says, just sort of marking time in terms of, you know, well, the papers get stamped. But boy, emotionally, does everything get stamped at the end?
You're right that he's a very reticent character in terms of wanting fame and publicity. But I think that's why that scene resonates so much at the end, because you're so happy that he's recognized that it, you know, I cried when I watched. I think everybody cried. So everybody bring some Kleenex when you watch this, because it's a weeper.
And you know what? Even Nicholas Winton tears up at the end. And because for the most part, he's got, you know, just like a placid demeanor. He's just not easily ruffled, and which actually is a virtue with that kind of rescue operation. You have terrible odds against you, but you just keep going, right? But then at the end, during the TV program, as these people greet him, when you see the tears in his eyes, You realize how much, and like in most movies, that's just a convention. Like, put the glycerin in the actor's eyes and watch the tear roll down. But this is a case where I was tearing up because I realized this was genuinely what I call honest and earned emotion, that he was choking up at that point. And that's quite thrilling to watch in the sense of this man who's been, I don't want to say bottled up, because it's not like repression. It's just more a matter of fact attitude that, you know, when you're in a crisis situation, you do what you can to help people. You don't want to be celebrated for it. You just want to do what you got to do.
And how many movies are really about decency? So that's why, if nothing else, that's reason enough to watch it. But let's move on to Love Lies Bleeding. So much I want to ask you about your opinion about this movie, Mike. I'll just say from the outset, I really liked this movie. But let's start with the title, because it almost sounds like three different unrelated words hooked together, which I think kind of works in terms of the movie. You can read it as Love Lies There Bleeding or Love Lies Bleeding, you know, in terms of telling falsehoods. So, Mike, starting with the title, what did you think?
Well, I actually had mixed and negative feelings about the film, so we may have some blood on the floor by the time we get done discussing it. But I agree with you. It's a really nifty title, Love Lies Bleeding. It's a perfect title for a film noir, which essentially this is what it is. And so often in film noir, among other things, you have love that's always a dangerous love, and you have this volatile love, if you will. Is it even love? In any event, there are going to be bloody consequences here. So it's an edgy thing. So I think the title does a good job of like hooking your interest. It's intriguing and kind of memorable that way. And it's really true to the subject matter. In terms of the sensibility of the film, you can take it all the way back to James N. Cain, if you will, you know, Postman Always Rings Twice type material. And it's a modern film noir in the sense that watching this, and this is one reason why I had mixed feelings about it. Watching this film, I felt like I had a checklist of sorts. In other words, you can see a little bit of David Lynch's Blue Velvet here. You can see any number of films by the Coen brothers. You have essentially a film noir story structure. And then in terms of the mood of it or the tone of it, this mix of violence that's meant to be violent and, oh my gosh, horrible violence, but comedy. And some scenes it works well, and others I felt it was kind of forced. And I felt like just as I was checking boxes, I thought the film was kind of pressing buttons that way. But in terms of the essential storyline, I'm not sure like how all lesbian viewers would respond to this film because, you know, if we're going to talk about gender and sexuality, this is very much the case here. But gosh, would I want to get into a relationship like this or even watch it? So I'm laughing just because it's so extreme. But Kristen Stewart plays a character named Lou, who's a gym employee. And she has, you know, any number of customers, clients, if you will. And one of them is a character named Jackie, played by Kitty O'Brien. Jackie is the loose cannon here. She's the destabilizing force. She's a female bodybuilder. She wants to get to Las Vegas for a job to pay her bills. She works on a gun range, which is an early indicator that there might be some guns in this story. She is taking steroids. And I know we have any number of editorials that caution you about taking steroids, but I think watching this movie is like the best editorial against taking steroids. Is it a roids fueled rage? To some extent, I would say yes, but she's pumping up in all sorts of ways and then pumping guns. She wants to build herself up and, of course, win this. She's really got like what I call a drifter character. This is Katie, Jackie, rather, so played by Katie O'Brien. So Jackie really is that like she's interesting, she's intriguing, but what a scattered past, what a dangerous track record she brings. But anyway, to sort of cut to the chase on this one, Lou and Jackie will initiate a romance, okay? And the film actually doesn't have a lot of over editorializing about same-sex love. It's not that kind of a film. And yet it is essentially the premise or part of the premise for the film is these two young women fall in love. Is it love? They certainly have a passionate relationship. And this is where there's always some edge to the relationship itself. So they don't even need outside forces in society to, in some ways, like disapprove of, you know, that same-sex love. Within the same-sex relationship, it's volatile. It's kind of unhinged because Lou, working at the gym and all, is a much more settled character. But Jackie, as I say, is just totally off the charts, unreliable, and just wild. You know, she sounds like fun company, but boy, fun can be dangerous. And so what really sort of tips it over the edge there is that Lou has a father called Lou Senior. It's easy to remember that way. He's played by Ed Harris, wearing a deliberately terrible wig. And he's the kind of character who's so dangerous that if Dennis Hopper were still alive, he would play a role like that. You know, it's just totally unwired there. This is where there are times where, as I watch this story, which is set in New Mexico in 1989 and very much a Coen Brothers type setting, I would say that way. Watching it, I thought, okay, I see the material they're working. But there were too many times where they were sort of pressing the button, like the Ed Harris character, Lou's father. It's so unhinged. It's almost cartoonish at times. I was laughing, and then after a while, I thought, oh, come on, give me a break. And then I don't want to spoil any of the plot twists, and there are a lot of plot twists here. I don't spoil any of them, but you know what, Maria, as it got into those plot twists, some of them were so extreme and so forced that I found myself sort of turning against the film. It's an example of what I call cinema that's trying too hard. It was like really pushing the envelope or the buttons, whatever mixed metaphors we want to use here. And that sort of turned me off after a while. Now, the final thing I'll say for this moment is that the movie itself, quite significantly, I would say, was very much a Sundance film. But within that Sundance milieu, it played the Sundance midnight section. So this very much is a midnight film. Whatever, you could see it at 10 o'clock in the morning. It's probably better to see it at 10 o'clock at night. But it's that kind of a movie. And so I would find it rather difficult to recommend it because I had so many reservations about it. But I got to tell you, I was not bored. I was never bored.
Well, I would recommend it, but I would say this is not a movie for everybody. I want to mention that Lou is played by Kristen Stewart, who I think is really, really good in this. And some of the things I really appreciated was this is directed by Rose Klass, who did a movie called Saint Maud, completely and totally bizarre. Not as much as this one, but worth watching if you do like this one. I like the way they use the female gaze as opposed to the male gaze, the sort of elusive storytelling, the nonverbal agreements you see going on between the women. It's explicit and shocking, but you don't actually see anything. I like the way they portray women as people and not cliches or symbols. I like the fact that it's supposed to be, the underworld and the whole movie, everything in it looks absolutely filthy. Everything's got kind of a, I don't know, it just looks like it has a residue of grime on it or cigarette nicotine stains. It's just that feeling that it gives you is terrific. And you're right on the money in terms of it being very much like a Coen Brothers movie. One thing that just kept going through my mind when I was watching it was how much I felt like this is what Drive Away Dolls wanted to be. But they, I think this was done so much better with some of the material. And I would also say, absolutely love Lou's dad, the wig that you mentioned. He looks like a cross between the crypt keeper and a cocker spaniel. And it kind of contributes to that whole weird oddity of the scenery and the situation. I thought it all worked really well together. It also seemed like a Tarantino movie.
Well, I actually do put it in the same category as Drive Away Dolls, where what happens is, I think, much as I like the Coen brothers, there can be a kind of mannerism. Certainly, film noir is no stranger to mannerism. And Drive Away Dolls, like trying too hard or hitting overly familiar buttons that way. And I thought both films did that. I do agree with you in terms of the female aesthetic, if I can put it that way, of having a female gaze, as women look at each other. And you're right, oftentimes there's no dialogue, it's just the looks between one and the other. And I actually really did appreciate that. But, as you also indicated, but what are they looking at and what are we seeing? And yeah, this is kind of a grimy movie. You want to go home and take a shower after watching it, I think. It has that. And so even though I could appreciate, like conceptually, that rather than always the male gaze, traditional male gaze, which you would get so often in film noir, let's have the female gaze flip it that way. And so sexuality really is an important issue here within the film, though it's not one discussed by the characters to any great extent, which I thought was rather interesting, actually. Like, it's a given in the storyline that the women love each other, but other people in town, they may condemn some of their actions, but aren't condemning the sexuality itself. And I found that kind of refreshing in its own way. But again, although I'll grant those points readily in terms of what's being seen, what's being viewed, a lot of that, as I said earlier, is like so extreme, so kind of forced and cartoonish that I wasn't laughing as much. And I just thought after a while, like, oh, come on now. And so I could appreciate, with Lou Senior, yeah, it's such a cartoonish depiction of this guy that I know I shouldn't be too long-faced and and serious and contemplating it, but it just seemed to me like kind of silly after a while. I wanted the film to have some genuine violent punch to it, and I could never quite, even though there are some violent scenes in it actually, and certainly suggested violence, but I could never quite feel that at gut level, because I was wanting to smirk and shrug it off, like, oh, come on now, okay, what next? And there always is as in film noir, there's always a what next, right? You think it's near the end, and then there's another twist there, and one more body goes in the ditch.
Well, you know, that's a good point. Now that I think about it, this is a good contrast to One Life, where, you know, the action was not, it was very subtle and subdued. Here, I felt on edge throughout the entire film, wondering what was going to come next, which is a little bit of a trick to do. Maybe not so much with film noir, it's always about that. But I want to mention one other character who I thought kind of stole the movie, which is Anna Baryshnikov, who plays Lou's, you know, former lover. And she is so sinister while also seeming sort of innocent. It's such a nuanced performance, but every time she comes on screen, you're like, oh no, what's gonna happen next?
You know, I agree with you there. She's like Trouble with a capital T, but she doesn't mean to be Trouble.
No.
She's so, like, so open and expressive and nice and, hi, great to see you, let's go party kind of thing. But don't let her in the car. Don't go partying with her. And she is bad news that way. But you're into it. It is a very subtle character as written and as played, because she doesn't mean to do bad, or she just somehow always does the wrong thing, right? And she just doesn't think, basically, right? But it's so much fun to watch the performance, because, you know, the moment she enters the frame, you're right, the actor's going to steal the scene, but also the character almost hijacks the movie, because I want to know her story more so. I wanted more with her, actually, in the sense that she's a really fascinating character.
She was a really fascinating character. So in terms of the story arc and the ways things sort of go off the rails at certain points, do you think that ruins the movie, Mike? Or do you think it's just part of the trying to do something really daring and different? I mean, I will say I've never seen a movie like this before.
Well, you know, I think it's an example of the film going off the rails. It really lost me in about the last half hour or so, for the reasons I stated before. And I think that's something that does happen with the Coen brothers. And you know, when you mention sometimes when it just gets like so extreme, one thing after another, it's like, oh, come on now, a kind of mannerism that way. And it can happen with Tarantino as well. Like with some of the violence in a Tarantino film, where you find yourself like cringing and then also laughing, that can be very effective. But if a scene goes on for another 3 or 5 minutes, you can start to feel like, okay, enough already. And then to put like an upbeat pop tune on top of that as the violence is being unleashed. So even though those were films that were different and were edgy, I think it's gotten to the point now where for directors like this, it's like overly predictable in its own way, even though some of the things that happen are unpredictable. And in another sense, it is predictable. I will say, and agreeing with you again very strongly, the fact that it's a female director and it is the female gaze, if you will, that makes this film somewhat distinctive, certainly a bit different from the norm. And so in that respect, it's one reason why I was sort of on the edge of my seat. Not that I wanted to leave the seat and leave the theater, but just simply that it was tense. And it was one thing after another. And I was, as I said before, I was never bored by it. It always held my interest. I wanted to see it. That's why the character Daisy is such a loose wire there. You never know what's going to happen when she enters the scene. And you know it's something bad, but that's film noir. And so I think, yeah, this is a director. It's only her second film. So I would love to see what she does next.
I'm glad you said that, because that's actually where I was going to end, which is I thought St. Maud was a ambitious, pretty good movie. Mm-hmm. I think this one is a whole lot better. So I'm really looking forward to what she does next time. I think she's very promising. Rose Glass, make sure you look for her. Okay, so that does bring us to the end of this episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And you can also find us on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also watch our episodes on HCC TV and Howard Community College's YouTube page. If you have ideas, suggestions, or comments, you can email us at movies@howardcc.edu or on Dragon Podcast social media, where you can interact with us, give us a like, drop a comment, and share our content with others. And we will see you next time at the movies.
See you then.